This is Digital Music Trends 138 on the 26th of June 2013. This week, a packed show with the TuneWiki, iTunes Radio, Control, Leakage, Spotify Apps, Eagles, Savna, Amazon Autorip, C3S, Pink Floyd vs. Pandora, Sony Music Unlimited, and Uber Stations. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends, the weekly show where we chat about and make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. So DMT is available on many platforms as both audio and a video podcast on iTunes, on most podcatchers, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And you can email me on andrea@digitalmusictrends.com with any feedback or drop me a line on Twitter. The handle is DGMusicTrends. And this week I'm really happy to welcome on the show Tom Satchwell for the first time on DMT. So Tom works in music and events marketing and has worked for Ditto Music as well as Liverpool Sound City in the past. So hi Tom, and great to have you on. How's it going?
Hey, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Great. So, and then we welcome back our longest standing guest who's been on the show, I think, 9 times so far, which is awesome. And it's Darren Hemmings from digital marketing firm Motive Unknown. Always a pleasure to have you on, Darren. How's it going?
Good. I'm a bit unnerved by the intro. Longest standing. Does that mean I'm going to get fired?
No, that's not what I meant, but, you know, it's fine.
Long overdue to be put out for pasture. Darren Hemmings, ladies and gentlemen.
No, that's not
what I meant. It's good to be here. Thank you.
And also, towards the end of the show, at the end of the show, I'm going to add on a short chat that I recorded with Michael Robertson last night on his new startup Uber Station. So look out for that at the end of the show. And today we start with sad news, which is the closure of the lyrics service TuneWiki. So in a blog post, it was announced by the company's CEO, Larry Goldberg, that the service will come to an end of operations starting on June 28th, which is this Friday. So it's quite a short notice, really, on the closure of the service. The note Goldberg wrote in the note that TuneWiki has come a long way from its early days when we pioneered the inclusion of scrolling lyrics into music playback. Over time, we blossomed into a vibrant music, social music service that has been enjoyed by millions of music lovers. The company was doing, pretty well, considering, in the sense that, you know, the Android app, Android Police, reported that it was downloaded over 10 million times, although the paid app didn't do anywhere near as well. It only had about 10,000 downloads for the $3 paid app on Android. It had a popular, iOS app. It's the number one app on Spotify at the moment still. And so, the news came as a bit of a surprise. First of all, on an emotional level, like when you saw this happened, Darren, what were your first thoughts, and were you surprised as well?
I was surprised, I must admit, only because it, particularly I think with the Spotify app, it's kind of emerged as more of the, the sort of dominant lyrics service that we all know of, matching, lyrics to tracks as they go and things like that. So in some respects, my initial response was like, oh, wow, that's quite surprising, because it's by no means the smallest player in that field. It was more or less the most well-recognized. I don't know whether it was technically the biggest, because, to be honest, I don't know enough to comment. It may be other services either, yeah, that by going more B2B are doing better elsewhere. I don't know. But, right. It was certainly a surprise. But then when you actually start thinking about it, and it's kind of like, where was the money in all of that? It's not particularly, so with a lot of this stuff, it's been quite hard to find out. I think it's seeing where the model is and realizing that you can't find it immediately then kind of gives you the answer as to perhaps why this has not succeeded beyond that. And I mean, I've seen mention elsewhere as to, does this model work as a business to consumer one? And I think that's probably up for debate in the wake of TuneWiki going under.
Yeah, and the company has been operating since 2007, so I guess, it comes to a point when, 6 years later, if you can't monetize the service that you have, that you have to call it a day. Tom, what's your take on this? And had you used the TuneWiki in the past? And, what do you think went wrong on that front?
I honestly don't know. Up until I saw the tweets being headlined, I hadn't even heard of it. So, just did a quick read and, tried to find out where they could have stumbled. First thing I looked at was, were they, in partnership with Spotify? You need to be. Found out they were. It just seems hard to understand where they've fallen. which obviously, with all the funding they've got, and if they're not monetizing, if you can't monetize, it seems to be the biggest drawback. Like you say, 6 years later, if you haven't got anything sustainable yet, then it's probably time to close doors.
Yeah.
But it just seems like a well-loved thing. Top 10 Spotify apps in 2012. It seems to be completely surprising that it's closed down a few months later.
Yeah, and it's surprising that it was just a closure that was announced. I mean, you would assume when it comes to an app that is relatively successful like this one, there would be a way to offlay at least the company to somebody that would want to buy it. So it's surprising that they just announced the closure of it rather than announcing an acquisition by somebody else. I guess on the one side, there's a bit of a commoditization of lyrics that is happening at the moment, because there are other services like, I think, Shazam, SoundHound, and Pandora has also incorporated lyrics as part of their offering, and so people expect them to see incorporated in other services as well. But at the same time, there's this company like MusicSmash that appears to be doing really well, and they've just launched a new iPad app, and this seems to be going all steam ahead, and they're also having a B2C core idea, where LyricFind, for example, has a more B2B API access basis for licensing the lyrics to other sites. So I don't know, do you think users are coming to expect lyrics to show up in apps that just offer music? And if so, can they be monetized as a standalone feature, or do they just have to be a cost that is eaten by a company like Pandora or like Spotify in the future, for example? Darren?
Well, I think for me, the question is, it comes back to that old thing of like, is it, what's the phrase? Feature, not a company. Where the core offering is ostensibly a good one, but not one that consumers would pay for. And I suppose that question has to be asked of, this kind of service, as to whether it's something that would fit a lot better into, the offering of someone like Spotify or whomever, and that potentially it becomes a little bit like, I don't know, Gracenote and things like that, or even Echo Nest to an extent, where it's a foundational support to a service, but isn't necessarily a sort of consumer-facing service in and of itself. And it seems to me that's probably where TuneWiki got it a little bit wrong. I mean, as I said, the bottom line is I just have no idea how they were making money. Yeah. And the problem with them was as I said to someone yesterday, it's kind of like, it was the number one app in the UK on Spotify, but Spotify doesn't make you any money. Spotify makes Spotify money, but the apps themselves don't directly generate revenue. They can't. I think it's against their terms of service.
Yeah, so I also wonder whether they were losing money by having this big Spotify presence, because I would assume that they would have had to pay something to publishers for displaying the lyrics on Spotify.
Yeah, I mean,
and so if they weren't making any money off it, then they were probably losing money through the Spotify app as well, which is probably not good. And Tom, on your side, do you think that there is maybe still a missed opportunity when it comes to lyrics? Because for example, I'm thinking about, I recently put out one of the EP of my old metal band from when I was in uni back on various services, and I did notice that there isn't any space for lyrics when it comes to the distribution. So if you are an unsigned artist and you're planning to self-distribute your songs, there isn't really a way to easily distribute lyrics together with the music. So do you find that's something that's missing, for example, from the current digital distribution area as well?
I think it could be, really. Going back to vinyl and CD, you expected to get the lyrics and artwork within the sleeve. It's just when we went down to MP3, we stripped everything back, and it was just, it's just the files. So it's probably things that people are looking for, but like Darren said, whether it can stand alone as a company is a completely different matter. With Pandora already implementing it, Spotify, I'm sure, will jump on board any moment. But as soon as you type into Google, monetized lyrics, all you get is a load of Yahoo queries about how you can monetize YouTube videos, self-made lyric videos on YouTube. Yep. So people go to YouTube to find out the lyrics now as well, because obviously they're not getting it when they download it through whatever source.
Yeah.
But I don't really see the need personally for an app on its own. If it was there on Spotify, as I could listen to the album, I'd happily have a read through.
Yeah.
But there's no curiosity for me to download an app on its own basis to read lyrics.
Yeah, and certainly LyricFind has an interesting model because they are licensing the lyrics that they license themselves to, over 1,000 different music sites that display lyrics. And so, of course, that makes it a more compelling proposition because, they are able to sell, the lyrics that they license and get more and more companies to put advertising next to them and, monetize them that way. I know that when I spoke to the CEO of LyricFind back at South by Southwest, he mentioned that display advertising is still the number one source of revenue for sites that operate by displaying lyrics, essentially. And so, yeah, that's interesting news, but, it's a sad news. I met the guy at TuneWiki, I met them maybe 4 years ago or 5 years ago. They had like a tiny booth over there, and I've been following the company ever since. So a shame to hear that's happening, but I wouldn't rule out a last minute acquisition of some sort, because it just seems weird that the company would just disappear like that. And moving on, I wanted to talk quickly about iTunes Radio, because it was an interesting article on Evolver FM by Elliot Van Buskirk that was summing up essentially what is happening at the indie level on iTunes Radio. So Digital Music News reported last week that it had confirmation of Apple sending out a pre-filled inferior contract terms to independent labels for iTunes Radio inclusion. Even though Merlin is not directly involved in most of the negotiations, as the deals with Apple's predate the formation of the organization for many of the members of Merlin, Merlin's CEO Charles Caldas told Evolver that he would be surprised if Apple was to discriminate against independent labels at this juncture, because the company has a good history and within the independent sector of treating them fairly. So, there was a lot of emphasis in the press last week about the big three labels, major labels signing, but then Apple didn't actually announce those particular deals during the event. They just mentioned that the service would be launching. So you can't really blame Apple for putting the focus on the majors on that particular front, because it didn't actually put that focus in the spotlight at the announcement. And at the same time, Apple does have an alternative. If they can't get a deal done with the labels directly, they could go via the compulsory licensing route via SoundExchange and via ASCAP and BMI in the US, although that would really restrict the way that they can use the music as part of the radio. So it's quite a complicated scenario, of course, because there's hundreds of labels that Apple has to get deals done with in order to launch properly for iTunes Radio. But Tom, do you feel like you agree with Charles Caldas in terms of Apple not having anything to gain by discriminating indie labels and offering them inferior contracts?
Completely, especially when in regards to Merlin. Look back, and Spotify went out of its way to integrate Merlin with the majors in its own licensing deals. So it just seems odd that Merlin's been left out at this point. No, but maybe like he said in his own statement, maybe they were just overlooked due to iTunes predating the formation of Merlin.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, iTunes for MP3 sales, it pays everybody the same amount. Everybody gets the same cut, whether you're major or an indie. So it seems odd now that iTunes are launching its own streaming service for them to start discriminating against independent labels.
Absolutely.
So, Merlin and larger indie label collectives, they're probably going to get, I'd imagine a fairer deal, probably similar to the majors, but I reckon. The smaller indies through distributors like Ditto Music and TuneCore and everything,
yeah.
Probably going to be seeing similar deals that they're already receiving from Spotify and Pandora.
Yeah, and there's nothing to say that beggars and the like haven't signed already. I mean, it's just the fact that when the deals are done with major labels, there's so many people involved that usually the news leaks before anything is announced. Darren, do you feel like Apple has been fair to the independent sector so far and so wouldn't have anything to gain by discriminating against it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly historically, it seems to have been a fairly egalitarian setup, although
yeah.
They're very different worlds, aren't they, as regards what happens when you get played on the radio versus, the money you see when you sell a download. So yeah. I suspect they're two very different conversations. I think what's been bothering me a little bit around this whole debate is that I'm just not entirely sure that the facts are out there. yeah. It seems like there's, you know, as you said, we don't know that deals aren't being done and that conversations aren't being had. So it's only because someone kind of said, oh, well, the three majors are on board. And there's been very little kind of clarification beyond that as to what conversations are being had, where and with whom. Now, I think, you know, there's been a natural element within business to try and kind of shaft the indies a little bit because they're the smaller man. And it's, you know, it's just the nature of business that if people can work over the smaller man to get, you know, a better deal, then they'll have a good go. But history's kind of proven equally that, particularly via things like Merlin, and now that, you know, indies hold quite notable kind of artists on their side, that ignoring them is sort of perilous, you know. So, yeah. But I just feel more than anything like we're not getting the full picture on this. It sort of annoys me intensely when really shitty blogs like Digital Music News start writing kind of 2 and 2 = 5 stories without a full grasp of the facts. And, you know, that's not the basis for a story, really. You know, it's I think maybe there's something in there, but I just think it's kind of very easy to paint the industry as like, oh, we're dinosaurs and Apple are evil and all these kinds of things. And, you know, there's no smoke without fire. This stuff does happen. And, you know, and I saw it firsthand where, you know, Apple would try and use its kind of business clout and its, you know, its dominance in the marketplace to dictate terms and things. But that's not really an Apple thing. That's just a business thing. And it does happen. It's not nice, but it's just a fact of business, really, generally. It's how the world works. But to sort of jump into this view that, you know, particularly that people like Digital Music News are presenting of sort of Merlin as being, you know, idiots and being very sort of, you know, conservative and backward in their views and all that stuff, I just think is ridiculous. And, you know, my experience has always been that the indies generally are very tough to fight their corner, but they're very savvy, they're very on it. And, you know, across the board, they're a sharp bunch and we should give them all and Merlin a bit more credit in this area. Because history has sort of shown that Merlin's actually been relatively good. Not necessarily perfect, but they're by no means the kind of simpering buffoons that certain blogs would like them to be painted as. So yeah. I think we need to cut them a bit of slack. And when we know the full facts, then maybe there's an argument and, you know, a case to answer here. But at the moment, I just don't think... my gut feeling is we don't know. I think there's probably conversations afoot, but we don't know with whom and you know, where in that discussion
where
we
they're
are.
Going. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's an interesting story. We'll definitely look out for any actual facts coming out of that in the next few weeks. And I wanted to go back to what we talked about last week, actually. We talked about the Jay-Z and Samsung deal. And there was an interesting article by Zach O'Malley from Forbes, which looked at this Jay-Z release and the Kanye West release. And he suggests an interesting point, which is that Jay-Z is essentially being paid $5 million to leak his own record, something that would have probably happened anyway, like it happened with Kanye. But the only difference is that Kanye didn't get the $5 million from it. So what do you guys think about that? Can the giveaway by Samsung be compared to a pre-release leak? And do you think in that vein, are we going to see more of these? And do you think it's a business savvy proposition for major artists to do? Because, you know, they kind of have to resign themselves to the fact that once they start distributing the record to digital stores, unless they have like a ridiculous embargo in place, the record is going to leak at least, you know, 2 or 3 days before release. Tom, what's your take?
I thought it was an interesting article at first. I didn't consider it that way. I didn't consider it a leak. I just thought it was a business partnership. As a major artist, you can't hurt Jay-Z. He's already considered a commercially successful artist. So, you know, he's partnered with brands before, so it's not something out of the norm for him.
Sure.
So, you know, if he's done is take control back, you know, if it was going to leak, you know, it might have done, we don't know, but all he's done is take control of the situation and he's done really well out of it. You know, whether Kanye's kicking himself for not doing the same thing is, you know, we don't know, but, you know, it's not something that's entirely new. You know, I know we're going to talk about BitTorrent later, but, you know, Public Enemy and Counting Crows, you know, a few people have partnered with different sites to, you know, not to essentially leak it, but to distribute it in a different way, for free. So it's just a different way of doing it. But Jay-Z's just made sure he's been paid for it.
Yeah, Darren, do you think it's comparable to a leak? And do you think at this point, you know, it's going to happen anyway? You might as well monetize it and make sure that fans don't want to get it.
I think everyone's getting a bit sort of drunk on the nomenclature around this. It's kind of whether it's a leak, whether it's an exclusive, is a bit, you know, you're talking about getting stuff maybe ahead of its official touchdown date through one means or another.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, whether it's a, like a paid leak is, that's an exclusive, isn't it? That's not a leak.
Exactly.
A leak is,
yeah,
like you didn't plan it. A leak is we had no idea someone else has taken our record and put it out.
Yeah,
so the notion of like it being a paid leak is a bit weird, frankly.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's sort of a paradox. It makes sense. But
yeah,
I mean, it's interesting. That whole debate, I think it's it kind of, you know, I talked about this on you know, with the Daily Digest. I've written a few bits about it. And David Emery at Beggars kind of wrote a blog post as a consequence of that. That was really good, you know, and I suspect you might have mentioned it last week, but, you know, it's worth a read on his site.
No, I don't think it was out when we recorded it.
Oh, right, okay. So, you know, and he was sort of saying, you know, at what point are you kind of selling out and going too far? Because his view was really, I think, that this felt like a step too far. And, I mean, it's funny with David because me and him often disagree on stuff, but then realise that, or I certainly realise he might disagree again, that, you know, you meet sort of somewhere in the middle, really. You know, his view is that this is probably a step too far. My view is that, you know, as Tom said, it's kind of like for Jay-Z, he's done so much stuff around brands and there's so much kind of entrenched business as an element of your culture within hip-hop that, you know, it just doesn't seem that weird to me. You know, the notion that he's done this, I don't think his fans would be sat there going, oh, my God, he's done what? But equally, like if Radiohead did it, then, you know, you would know full well that fans would be absolutely up in arms.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's complicated. There's never a kind of cut and dried element to this. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you can do it and you can get away with it, which I think Jay-Z can, then why not? You know what I mean? It's a great way to monetize. You know, you're basically selling like a million or whatever records kind of up front and getting the cash straight in your pocket. So,
yeah,
you know, tricky one, but yeah, as for this kind of notion of it being like a paid leak, that's a bit weird, you know, by the same notion. That's like Daft Punk did a leak to Apple for a week before release, and like where does this, you know, Alt-J did a SoundCloud leak a week before their album came out.
Yeah,
where does it stop, you know? That's a bit weird. It's just, we're playing,
I guess it's just it's just a question of controlling the source of where that stuff comes out from, I guess. It is.
I mean, it, you know, you, but you know, everyone likes to think they do control the source.
Because I guess it's easier.
Most do, you know.
Yeah, because I guess it's easier. You know, if you start streaming your album on iTunes a week before release, then thinking about it from a digital release perspective, then you could actually only start sending the album to all the other stores, you know, the day after you start the streaming on iTunes, and so that means that, you know, even if you did have a leak from one of those stores, which, you know, there's hundreds in the world, it's very hard to control what happens with the files after you send them, then it means that at least that people have a one place where they know that they can get it anyway and listen to it anyway, and they're less interested in the leak itself. That's the only benefit.
I think really this to me boils down to, you know, giving, you know, trying to understand what fans want and when,
yeah,
and then balancing that against, you know, the potential revenue to be drawn from that and whether it's going to piss the fans off, you know.
Yeah.
If you sit there and go, oh, you know, someone's going to pay me 10 million quid to shoot my CD to the moon and leave it there for a week before release, I'll do that. You know what I mean? And that's not very wise. But, like, you know, with the Jay-Z Samsung thing, it's funny because, like, that, you know, there's a lot of people using Samsung devices. And it's funny because I may be off on it, but I think, you know, a lot of music industry people use Apples and, you know, and iPhones as products. And it's kind of the people I saw grumbling hardest about this, I would stake a lot of money on owning an iPhone. And sometimes that can make you a bit myopic as to the broader deal of, like, the man in the street. And I think, you know, Samsung are selling an absolute ton of these things.
Yeah.
You know, and they're free to Samsung device owners. Have you seen how many Samsung devices are out there? There's about 30. You know, everyone thinks there's like one handset. There's not. There's like a raft of these things. So there's a huge potential reach.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just think, to be honest, you know, as I said, in hip-hop generally, it's kind of, you know, if you haven't launched like a clothing line and a vodka brand, then you're clearly not doing very well. So in that world, kind of releasing stuff, you know, in advance to Samsung owners is kind of de rigueur. You know, it's to be expected. And I just think other fans will wait. And you know what? If someone leaks it and then it winds up all over peer-to-peer as a result, then maybe that's the backlash, and that's the indication that maybe you did go a bit too far with this one and you should reconsider in future, you know, because it could be that it does leak and everyone rushes in, you know, in their bid to get it because it's locked out for non-Samsung device owners, you know, that then it gets downloaded a load of times and doesn't get sales, you know, things like that. So we'll see. But I think I have to say, actually, another part of this that I think hasn't really had much debate yet is the degree to which his option to use Samsung within, you know, his campaign will potentially damage his chances of getting kind of love from iTunes, for example, and things like that. Like, to what extent would other retailers get behind this, knowing that he's taken it to, certainly in the case of Apple, like the number one kind of competitor at the moment, you know? And I my gut feeling is that I suspect iTunes will just sort of man up and put it on a brick on the front, because they know that it is guaranteed to sell an absolute ton of stuff. So only a fool would ignore it. It's a business transaction at the end of the day. But even so, that's sort of something I've not seen much mention of, is like, to what extent has that exclusivity damaged his relationship with other retailers?
Yeah, absolutely. That's quite interesting. And I just wanted to backtrack a little bit, going back to the TuneWiki Spotify app idea, because it was an interesting blog post by Alison Lam from Believe on the Medium blog this week. And she was talking about how Spotify apps can increase listeners for specific artists and tracks that are involved in some of those app releases by up to 400%. And so she mentions a classical label, X5, for example, that saw their plays shoot up 412% for the release of the 50 greatest pieces of classical music when they released the app Classify on the service. And that also led to a 50% increase in digital sales on iTunes. And the Earache Metalizer app generated 23,000 playlists in the first day. Blue Notes app, which was developed via the EMI Sandbox project, has also been very successful. And Sounddrop, which is an actual startup rather than a label-funded app, is also doing very well with thousands of listening rooms and a lot of activity on there. So here's the thought: you know, is the value in the Spotify apps purely to drive plays and increase revenues for the music, or is there a potential business model beyond that? Of course, you know, that's a question that people are asking themselves as labels have to invest money in building these apps, as startups are looking at whether it's worth having an app on Spotify or not, and whether that helps their business or not. And of course, startups that are wanting to build their whole business on, or start their business on, the Spotify ecosystem, that becomes pretty hard. And we've seen the app called, I think it was TuneEgo, that it got acquired by Spotify in the end, which was, I guess, one way of making money out of this model. It's an interesting ecosystem. And of course, the fact that there's more and more apps being released, and there isn't much of an organization yet on the system as to how you discover those, makes it a much more noisy environment. It makes it harder to discover, and so the investment becomes less and less justifiable unless you have really the marketing push to push these apps. So I don't know, Tom, what's your take on all this? It's quite a complicated subject, but I think it's worth bringing up, because, you know, we're now in this, almost in July of this year, and we haven't seen any major update to the app ecosystem on Spotify since they made their big announcement last December that they would overhaul the client.
I don't know. It's not one I know too much about. From what I know, the business model is, you know, you pay to get your app on, and you can't monetize. But from what I've seen of a few blog posts about trying to monetize apps that use Spotify, is that they're all saying just use it as a lead back to your primary site. Whether that's, you know, that's obviously not the number one solution, and people are obviously looking elsewhere. But, you know, we're seeing as all the apps, if apps are driving, you know, for further streams and, you know, forward to discovery, and, you know, personally, some of the apps that are on there is what drove me to actually join Spotify in the first place.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's probably the same for a lot of people. You know, it's the addition of these, you know, of things like Sounddrop and We Are Hunted. You know, I use both of those and enjoy them both, you know, immensely. But if they can't monetize, then it's
pretty difficult.
It's going to get a bit difficult for them to, you know, like we saw with TuneWiki, they're just going to fall off the radar a little bit.
Darren, do you have any thoughts on that? Because, of course, you know, it must be something that you sometimes consider, I guess, working with bands and thinking about how best to do their digital marketing. That's Spotify is a huge platform. And on the other side, you know, there's the apps and there's also, you know, the artist pages, which are now, in a way, sort of vying for attention over the apps because people can follow artists through the artist page. How does that balance work as well?
I mean, I think the... Yeah, I mean, there's a few bits to get through there, isn't there? I mean, the apps, I think, you know, good apps work. It's as simple as that, really. I think there's been some great apps, and there's been some really shitty ones as well, you know. And they, you know, but the best ones rise to the top, which, you know, in terms of adoption and usage, I think works. But as Tom sort of touched on, and as we sort of said earlier, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it can monetize. I worry slightly that there's, you know, we've seen a lot of mudflying in Twitter's kind of ecosystem around this notion of like get people to build stuff based upon your platform and then at the point at which it is most convenient for you, shut them down, you know, or, you know, find means to, you know, turn off the fire hose so that their access is crippled or, you know, you change the agenda somewhat. And my gut feeling is that Spotify probably aren't going to do that. But again, you never know, you know, and it's, I mean, I sincerely hope they won't. But the, you know what I mean? There's been, there's just been a few things like this along the way now elsewhere where history's kind of taught us that they, you know, sort of sit there and go, here's a, you know, here's a lovely area for you guys to go play in, go forth, play. And everyone goes and plays. And then they, you know, when they reach a certain level, they sort of start saying, oh, hang on, we'll pull that back and we'll do that. Yeah. A bit like we're seeing with Facebook kind of aping Vine, you know, with the Instagram video features. Sure. It's like you have to find a way of making this work better and integrating it to your own setup. So I think with the apps, it's tricky because, you know, I've seen other people talking about this, you know, relative to their websites where, you know, it's great that someone like Pitchfork or the NME have an app on there, but what does that do to their actual revenues? Because if people are using the app more where they can't serve ads and can't monetized, then actually it's detracting from their core business, which is their own website where they've got complete control to kind of run ad inventory and everything else. So it's certainly tricky in that respect. I think, you know, Spotify as a client is just that, you know, they absolutely clear as day have some kind of mega update looming that will pull all of this into sharp focus.
Yeah.
And if you look, all of the little signs are there. You know, even Daniel Ek saying the other day that he's got this dream where there can be location-based music recommendations and everything. And it's like, well, you know, the guy does happen to run like the world's, you know, one of the world's sort of biggest or certainly best-known music streaming services. So you can bet your bottom dollar that they're going to be looking at that being some kind of function to come. Yep. You know, you're standing near London, do you want to see what everyone else around you is listening to, stuff like that. So there's a whole load of things coming, and, you know, the app integration, I think, will be a part of that, where you'll see more of it across mobile. But generally, I just think the best stuff will float to the top. I think it's, you know, there are some really, really good apps on there that are very complementary to Spotify's kind of core offering.
Yeah.
And as I said, there's a few others that really just are a bit sort of, you know, dross. They're not that great.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think it can help. I always question, like I read Alison's piece, and, you know, I know Alison, she's a very sharp lady, but, you know, as soon as I read pieces where people quote percentages in growth and stuff like that, I immediately get the kind of cynicism klaxon sounding, because, you know, 400% growth in plays could be from like 100 to 400. You know, without slightly harder numbers to back this up, it's,
yeah,
complex. It's a tricky area.
Complex at best. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And this is just a mention, because it seems like every week I'm thinking whether I should establish a drinking game on the show, although it we're recording in the morning when we talk about Spotify holdouts. And there should be more drinking on the show, I think. I don't drink enough on it. And the Eagles have also abandoned, you know, their streaming holdout, and their entire catalog is now available on all streaming platforms from yesterday. So this is a fairly big news, because the Eagles are one of the biggest bands in the US. You know, they're the last record in 2007 sold a gazillion records in the States. So definitely big news. And that's following Pink Floyd last week. And so I wonder what's going to happen next week and whether we're going to be able to drink something next week if somebody else ends their holdout against Spotify. But that's essentially just a service news because there's not much commentary to do on that. It's just bands realizing that they can make money on Spotify and audio and Deezer and getting on the bandwagon, essentially. And I wanted to talk about a couple of sort of more gaming related matters, because there's a couple of interesting stories coming out of Sony and Xbox. So both platforms have been trying to get a position in the music market. You know, Sony has got their Sony Music Unlimited, which is cross-device, works across all Sony devices, and they also have outside OS applications as well. And Xbox Music has also been trying really hard to gain a piece of the market in that sense since they launched the last year. So starting with Sony Music Unlimited, you know, they are adding pieces to the puzzle. You know, they dropped their prices incredibly from what the competitors are proposing. So I think that it's like a 50% discount if you get a yearly subscription to Sony Music Unlimited over what you'd pay for a year for Spotify or Audio. And they also launched the caching for their iOS application, so that makes them a lot closer to their competitors on that front. You know, it remains to be seen how well they advertise all this and whether people are actually going to go back to the Sony Music Unlimited application after perhaps trying it out and figuring that it had a lot less features last year than comparably RDO or Spotify or Deezer. I don't know. First of all, you know, Tom, do you feel like Sony Music Unlimited has got a chance of resurging thanks to all these new things and the fact that Sony is potentially taking also a loss on the yearly subscription for the music as well?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. You know, offline playback is the next thing, I'd say, with streaming. You know, until you've got 100% access, there's always going to be a downside with streaming. So, you know, with Sony bringing that in, it's ahead of the game, I suppose. You know, obviously, with a few different streaming services, you can take off a few playlists, but until that's 100%, it's always going to be a downside. You know, that's why I'll always have my iPod on me, because I won't always have 3G or Wi-Fi anywhere. So, you know, I want my music when I want it, not when I've got Wi-Fi. So if it's something that can, yeah, you know, if it's something that people are interested in, you know, it can only help them.
Yeah, and Darren, I was at the Sony Music Unlimited launch press release conference. I think it was 2 years ago at MIDEM. And since then, you know, the service is huge. It keeps launching in new countries, but we don't really know much about the level of subscriptions. Do you think that stuff like this and maybe the PS4 launch, which is going to bring focus back onto Sony, and it seems to be having really good PR, is going to bring the music offering back into focus?
I don't know. Like, I quite like it too. I mean, I used to work at Sony, so I sort of feel a twisted sense of allegiance, even though, frankly, I didn't leave under particularly good circumstances. So we're a battered wife relationship on reflection. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they're a funny bunch, right? Because they're, you know, they had it all there for the taking at the turn of the century. Bearing in mind, you know, even then they were trying to, I mean, it's changed names so many times, but, you know, they had a music service then. But the problem was that they were so obsessed with trying to restrain everyone to being purely within the Sony ecosystem that, you know, everyone jumped ship, because it was kind of like, well, you can only, you know, you can only use our music service on a Sony device, and then the devices weren't much cop. And, you know, it was a similar tactic to Apple, you know, but Apple obviously worked because they made the devices amazing, whereas Sony's were merely functional.
Yeah.
And it's sort of weird, because you think with all of the things that they have with the PlayStation, and, you know, they've got Sony Music as, you know, the label, as it were, they've got the services, you know, they've got the whole electronics division as well.
The TVs,
you know, they've got the potential to sort of connect it up, but they just seem to have got, they really sort of descended at some point into this kind of terribly corporate environment where they just sort of, it feels like they lost sight of the consumer, really, and what the consumer wanted. Something I thought, though, that has been a very interesting kind of indicator was that they've, on a couple of areas now, they've shown a sort of determination to try and embrace, like, hackers and a slightly more kind of go-to attitude. So they've had this smartwatch that they've built that everyone kind of crucified for just having like poor design and generally not really being like the best, you know, product. And so they've kind of now thrown it open and just said to developers, like, you know, do your best, like, do whatever you want to do, build it, and let's see what we can make here. And I like that. I think that's a very wise attitude now to show that they're a bit more keen to listen to what people want. Because, you know, at the end of the day, while some developers can veer too much into geeky world, as you sometimes see at sort of Music Hack Days and things, there are also others who will build incredible new features that should be adopted by these kinds of products. Yeah. So I think it's a signal that potentially they might be getting more into a place where they do embrace what people are saying to them and don't just try and shut the front doors and do everything internally and feel like they know best. And if that was applied to the music service, then it may work. I just think at the moment you're now seeing, you know, I mean, God, if you go back 2 years, you know, there were only about three players in the streaming music services market, particularly outside the US. Now, I mean, you know, everyone's doing it. It's between, you know, Google have entered the fray, Microsoft, you know, all of these people are weighing in and it's really, really hotting up. So in that, there, you know, if Sony had done this 2 years ago, they could have made a difference.
Yeah, definitely.
Now they've got to work much, much harder because there's just so many people in that space. And right now I'd say the Sony brand is pretty tainted, you know, and there's a reason that people like Daniel, whatever it is, the investor, you know, who's calling for them to spin off the entertainment division into its own kind of entity, you know, to keep it sharp, you know, all of that stuff, whilst absolutely true, doesn't help the Sony brand, which is continuing to be painted as a little bit out of touch.
But there's still people that do worse. For example, if you look at Xbox, I would love to know what the numbers are if you compare Xbox Music to Sony Music Unlimited, because Xbox Music has been completely locked down since release around a year ago, I think. You know, it's only available on the Xbox 360, Windows 8, and Windows Phone 8. And so Tom Warren at The Verge actually this week wrote an article saying that Xbox Music is going to launch a web-based version of the service. It will be apparently announced next week, although it won't launch next week. But again, it feels like way too little, way too late. I mean, there's no iOS or Android app, which is the primary way we're... how people are consuming their music these days. And I just don't understand how people could justify paying a subscription for something that just sits in the living room, or if they happen to have a Windows 8 phone. You know, even if you can access it through a desktop computer now with the web-based access, it's still not enough to justify a subscription. But what do you guys feel about it?
I'll go first then. It just seems like... After E3, Xbox are just in bad shape, it looks like. Obviously, it's probably been a long time coming, the web-based version, but like you say, you know, with such a limited possibility of actually using a paid subscription, there's no draw to it. You know, I haven't got a Windows phone. I've got an Xbox, but I'm not just going to sit and listen to music on my Xbox. I'll have my laptop on if I'm on my Xbox. It's fine. You know, yeah. I've got other places I can listen to music. I don't have a Windows phone, so... like you said, it just seems too little too late. It's not broad enough to justify paying a subscription for it.
Yeah. Darren?
What he said.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't really a story to comment on. It was just kind of like, what the hell?
But it's you know, you see it across the board. You get a lot of these very token entries. It reminds me of when Tesco started a download store, you know. It's very just like, oh, we're going to do this because someone else is. And it was a really half-assed entry into that area, you know, that just showed a complete lack of understanding of the marketplace and what people really wanted and all those sorts of things. And, it's a funny one because you'd think on paper, like, Xbox would have a chance of capturing those kids that are gaming. Those kids that are gaming don't spend money on music.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when you've got a YouTube app on your Xbox and that's what kids use to listen to music. You're immediately fighting that, and it's just weird. It's kind of tokenistic, and there's a bit of it where you feel like, look, either do it properly or just bugger off, you know, because you sort of come in, you're going, well, we've got a music thing, but what are you really delivering there, you know? And at the moment, in the face of the likes of Spotify or you know, even the kind of superior, you know, interface experiences you get, things like audio and that, they just, they don't really stack up. So it's a funny one.
Yeah. And I wanted to finish with a few bits of news from around the world, because, of course, we are trying to keep an eye on everything that's happening, which is kind of hard, but, you know, that's all we try to do. But, you know, there's a few bits of world news that are quite interesting this week. So first stop is in Germany, where I wanted to mention that apparently the site golem.day reported yesterday that Amazon will be launching its AutoRip service in Germany after coming to an agreement with GEMA, as well as with majors and hundreds of independents. So the service will be available on a broad range of recordings, around 500,000. And an Amazon spokesperson said they were excited about the launch because whilst in the US, physical has become a minority of the music market, in Germany, it's more like 80% of the market. Sorry, physical is more like 80% of the market. And so it'll be interesting to see how people adopt the additional cloud offering from Amazon. And so AutoRip, of course, if you haven't heard of it, allows users to access physical the physical CDs they purchase from Amazon from the cloud music service without having to rip them and upload them. So that's a story to keep an eye on, just because it's be interesting to see whether the adoption, I think Amazon is going to be potentially surprised by the adoption rates of that, you know, in a primarily physical market. And so that's interesting. And staying on Germany, the service C3S, well, the company C3S, which is a Creative Commons-backed project that is aiming to become an alternative collection society in Germany and across Europe, is going to launch a crowdfunding campaign next month to allow it to take some first steps towards becoming that entity. So the campaign wants to roll 3,000 members that are each going to pay 50 euros. The goal is to raise 150,000 euros in total, a third of which will be used to set up the company, and 100,000 euros will be used for the technical development of the society's back end. So we all know how difficult it must be to try and set up a society from scratch, considering how many things have to be tracked and considered and divided and stuff. But take a look at the C3S website. I'm going to throw the links in the show notes. And if you're interested, you can check out when their crowdfunding starts. And also check out the one-to-one show episode 5 that I recorded with Wolfgang Senges, who's one of the founders a couple of months ago, I think. Guys, any thoughts on either of those stories in terms of GEMA actually doing a deal with Amazon, which is interesting, and you know, a potential for an alternative to GEMA in Germany?
I think it would be interesting. You know, I mean, that's the problem now, isn't it? Is GEMA are just so, you know, they're just the albatross around most people's necks in Germany. You know, it feels like even artists don't want to support GEMA anymore. You know, it's such a strange thing, and it's a massive pain in the neck relative to, you know, video premieres on YouTube and things like that. And, you know, it's so, yeah, there's, you know, they've got to be one of the most hated organizations out there, I would have thought. Yep. If you were to, you know, per capita in Germany, I would have thought more people loathe them than do the RIAA in the US, you know. So I'm amazed they've done the deal with Amazon, but equally good, you know, all power to them. I think it's great because, as you said, there's a hell of a lot of physical products sold there.
Yeah.
But it's no shock to see someone trying to set up an alternative to GEMA but, you know, just the very fact that that has come about says a terrible amount about how GEMA are perceived, you know. It's just a shame.
They have a terrible PR as well, like that. They need to hire
somebody.
I mean,
their PR couldn't get any worse, could it?
Exactly,
they've hit like the absolute zero point where PR is concerned. No one could think worse of them. You know, they're just dreadful. And so, you know, and I think it's just a shame that it's come to that. I mean, how many years are we into this YouTube GEMA dispute? And I understand it's complicated, and I understand that, you know, both sides have arguments there, and people are playing hardball and all that kind of stuff. I get it. But you've just reached this point where, like, whatever the deal is, it will struggle to kind of compensate against what's been lost to date by way of this kind of gratuitous deadlock. And I think that's just a shame. You know, it reflects badly on all involved, and it's lousy. So,
and it's difficult for me to understand it, especially following the conversation I had with the CEO of SACEM, who was talking about how happy they are of the deal they managed to reach with YouTube. And SACEM has always been a fairly, you know, hardcore society to deal with when it came to making deals. So if SACEM are happy with the deal they made with YouTube, you know, I'm surprised that Gamma haven't managed to come to some sort of agreement with the company.
I think the Gamma thing now is kind of in this farcical point where Gamma won't even sit at the table because YouTube, they're saying YouTube are demanding that they sign NDAs around the whole discussion before they even sit down. So you're now in this like ridiculous scenario where they're arguing about even meeting up to talk about the actual argument.
Yeah.
You know, they just need the bloody heads knocking together. It's totally ridiculous.
And on some points, like I know SASM were very, very strict about not having NDAs on the rates. And you know, I think they won that battle. So, you know, I think that there are points where YouTube is willing to give way if there's stuff that can be done. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting thing to see what happens with that. And also moving on to a couple of news coming from Asia. So first of all, the digital music market is set for more growth in India, where the music service Savna, which is the leading service for Bollywood and South Asian content, has struck a deal with Tata Docomo, which is one of India's largest mobile operators. And the subscribers will have access to Savna's catalogue of 1.1 million songs via a special Stream Anywhere data plan with no Wi-Fi necessary. So there's going to be three different plans. And the interesting thing is that that particular network has a very large portion of the younger demographic, so it's going to be very interesting to see what happens on that front and whether that gets people to convert into subscribing for music. And of course, the prices are sensitive to the market and to what people are willing to pay over there. So, interesting development, and I'm looking forward to see what happens there. And also, talking about alternative markets in the Middle East, the company Angami has reached 2 million downloads. So they've only been around for a year, and they cover the Middle Eastern and North African markets by focusing on local catalog, although they also have deals with the majors. You know, they have a Spotify-like model. They're number one in a number of territories as on the iTunes App Store, for example, Saudi Arabia. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. And you can actually try Angami yourself. It's restricted to the local content that they have from the Middle East. They don't have international content for if you access it from the US or from the UK, but you can go and download the Angami app. It's quite a nice experience, and you can discover some cool and random Middle Eastern music if you do that. So a couple of interesting news from Asia on that front. And guys, I wanted to end today by talking about Pandora. I mean, we talked about it so much last week that I feel like we're beating, like, no, I don't know, something. A record in terms of like covering something week after week after week. But this news that keeps cropping up about Pandora, and it just won't stop. It seems like really we're at a turning point where the company needs to start thinking about whether being so open with their opinions on, not with their opinions, but being so, you know, confrontational with the industry is becoming a hindrance for them rather than a benefit. And so Pink Floyd published an op-ed on an editorial on USA Today that was signed by Roger Waters, David Gilmour, and Nick Mason. And they essentially make the point that they're not happy with the fact that Pandora has been writing to artists, asking them to write to Congress in support of internet radio when they don't mention anywhere that they're actually backing a bill that would essentially cut artist royalties by 85%. So essentially, they're just asking for transparency. They are being relatively sensible, like reasonable, saying that, you know, they understand that there are issues and that people should talk, and maybe there are things that can be changed, or rates could be lowered, maybe perhaps, or, you know, there might be ways that the two sides can come together. But you know, this sort of campaign where Pandora is trying to recruit artists to help them make a point with Congress is not good in their view. And so that's just one of many different points of views that I've come across this week on Pandora's issues and how people feel about them. And it's really starting to polarize the industry quite a bit. And I think from a PR perspective, it's definitely falling into the, you know, music industry's favor right now, as far as press is concerned, I think. Darren, do you have any particular feelings towards this story? I know you haven't been on the show for a few weeks since Pandora has really gone
I get
mad
to do the 4 week ranting catch up.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, yeah, because the last 4 weeks has really been full on for Pandora in terms of actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? You sort of reach this point where, like, I saw Jason Herskovitz tweeting the other day saying, you know, Pandora really need to fire their PR agency now. You know, they've got a serious brand problem going. And I think that's very true. Like, their name is just being dragged through the mud. and it looks terrible. You know, it's sort of reaching that point where it's just embarrassing. You know, and it's kind of like that needs to stop. But I think it is tricky. I mean, I think it's easy to demonize Pandora on this one, but you know, I did see a good point made somewhere else that you know, at the end of the day, there is something a little bit ridiculous about the notion that playing a song involves different monies, you know, depending on where you hear it. Like, if you heard it on the radio, then the artist is paid this much. And if you hear it on an online radio, they're not paid that much. If you heard it because you chose to play on Spotify, then they're paid this much. And it's like that conceptually is a bit weird when you think about it. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense. But equally, you know, it is a continual bugbear of mine around startups, particularly ones that claim to be, you know, use awful terms like being disruptive, where, you know, there is a threshold at which point, you know, quite simply, if the argument is that your suppliers have to drop their rates in order for your business to be viable, then your business model clearly isn't very well plotted out.
Yeah.
You know, and this sort of, you do see this a lot with startups. You go, well, you know, if we'd have got everything for free, we could have made money. And it's like, yes, but that's a shitty business model. You know, that doesn't work for the people supplying to you. Yeah. And that kind of basically applies to Pandora, you know, this kind of immediate response of, we have to drop the rates, you know, otherwise the business doesn't work. It's kind of like, they say that like it's anyone's problem. You know, if the business doesn't work and it goes under, well, then you wind up like TuneWiki. Yeah. And it's just, it doesn't, you know, your business was never going to survive. So I think it is complicated, but I think what the Pink Floyd thing shone a light on, which was particularly embarrassing for Pandora, was the slightly underhand and duplicitous way in which they are sending these letters to artists saying, you know, please support us, we get you loads of plays, you know, without really being particularly clear on the true agenda there. That's, you know, quite aside for, you know, the argument itself is one thing, and that's quite complicated, and I accept that that's got layers to it and it's problematic. But kind of being caught with your pants down, sending these things to people and making these demands, particularly when it's like Pink Floyd. Like, they just got called out by Roger Waters, you know. That's embarrassing. Like, when was the last time Pink Floyd issued a statement about anything? It was like Live Earth or whatever it was, you know, Live 8. So, you know, short of global poverty and hunger, this has actually prompted the oldest rock dinosaurs to come out and give you a firm kicking. Yeah. So, you know, in that respect, you know, they, my God, they really hit a low point when Pink Floyd are weighing in. You know, what next, Bono? It's terrible. So,
Tom, any thoughts on that? And do you feel like, looking at this, I was asking actually one of the guys last week that hadn't really been following the story a lot, but, you know, he really felt like the balance was shifting towards the public being more sympathetic with artists, even though they love Pandora, because, you know, so many hundreds of people, hundreds of millions of people use it in the States.
Yeah, I completely agree with pretty much everything Darren just said. You know, it is a PR nightmare. You know, and the whole, you know, doing mass mail outs, they're doing it from, you know, different employees within the company, trying to make it personal, I suppose. But, you know, what I saw was apparently a quote from the email saying, and they used the word exposure. And I don't think anything will piss off artists more when it comes down to talking about royalties than the streaming service talking about exposure. So I don't see how that's going to get anybody on board. You know, they're just not helping themselves at all. You know, the number of, you know, things that they've tried to do, you know, buying that terrestrial radio station, you know, they're doing one thing, but then telling the ice, you know, we're doing this for our benefit, but can you support us, please? It's never going to work.
Yeah.
I just would not like to be in their PR team, like you said. It's a nightmare.
it's a nightmare, and I think this is the fact that they're just taking all of this head on, and like the fact that they, when they bought that terrestrial station, they put a blog post out detailing exactly why they were doing it and accusing ASCAP of driving them to do this, and, you know, being a pain essentially and all that. And I'm sure, like, I don't know, it comes to a point where it's probably better to continue having closed doors conversations than to putting it out there for the whole world to complaining about what's happening. And I don't know, it just seems like
the whole strategy to it is just ropey as hell, isn't it? You know, as Tom says, it's that point where, you know, like the whole radio station buying thing was just, you know, so clearly a ploy to, you know, to make a move to sort of force the rates down. That, you know, on the one hand, they're like, we love you, buy the station. You know, it just... It's awful, yeah.
And it was actually like, it's a good, business-wise, it's a good idea, and it's perfectly legitimate if they can get it through. I mean, people do it with, you know, I heard people comment that people do it with tax all the time. They use loopholes in order to pay lower tax. And, you know, if that's something that they wanted to do and try as a business, there's no harm in doing that. But the fact that they did it and then they flaunted it in the industry's face in a very open blog post, you know, I'm sure they could have done all of this pretty much behind closed doors, applied for the lower rate, maybe it would have come out in the press, but it wouldn't have been quite so front page as it was. So yeah, an interesting strategy anyway. We'll see how it works out for them. I think we're getting to the end of the show. It's been an hour, so sorry, guys, I kept you a long time today. But if you're listening, stay tuned. Right after we finish here, it's going to be the short interview with Michael Robertson and his new radio startup. In the meantime, guys, if you have anything that you want to plug or any project that you're working on or artist or anything like that, please go ahead. Darren, I'll start with you. Anything you're on? You know, you have to have this ready by now. You know, it's
I know. It's coming. Working with so Eliza and the Bear, new band I'm working with, just unveiled their new single Friends, which is brilliant. Look that up, really, really good song. Zane Lowe's been playing it and raving about it. Spring Offensive, another new band I'm working with, who are really good. I've just put out a new single, Speak, that's equally brilliant, so go and look that up. A new label. I work with Houndstooth as well, who are Fabric's new label, and they've got an amazing set of artists there. They seem to be rating like the highest set of reviews for their opening kind of 4 or 5 releases for anyone I've ever worked with, where they've all had like 4 out of 5, 9 out of 10, stuff like that. So Rob Booth, the A&R man there, is absolutely killing it. But they've got a new band called Snow Ghosts. They're well worth looking up. It's a busy time at the moment. There's a lot going on. It's all good.
So I would tell people that are listening, you know, if you need anything, you know, go email Darren. It's probably not a good thing to do.
I'm just sitting around here. I've got like time on my hands.
He's got time on his hands. Yeah, exactly. Right, Tom. Any project you're on?
Well, just continue with the Bees on Toast posts. That you know, they try and come out monthly as
that's
I do.
That's beesontoast.com.
Beesontoast.wordpress.com.
Great.
But then, as well as that. Establishing a new PR company with a few friends that have studied journalism. So that's called Fortitude Press, Fortitude PR, sorry. But at the minute, we're building the site for that, you know, building our client list in a few negotiations, luckily, at the minute, and just building up the mailing list. So that's great. Something that I'm pretty excited about, but it's a slow process, but we're getting there.
Awesome, that's cool. Well, thanks so much, guys, for coming on the show. And now, as promised at the start of the show, my interview with Michael Robertson. So it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show today Michael Robertson. So hi, Michael, and great to have you on. How's it going?
It's going great, Andrea. Thanks for having me on your show.
That's great. Well, you know, I had you back in 2010. We're talking about MP3 tunes at the time. It's great to have you back talking about your new project, which is called Uber Station. So tell me all about it. First of all, what is it about?
Uber Stations is an online radio service. I think my premise is that there's been a tremendous investment in on-demand music. And I'm thinking, you know, Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, et cetera. But consumers are saying what they want is radio. Yeah. And you can see that by looking at the monstrous numbers of users and hours of listening that companies like Pandora and TuneIn have, which absolutely dwarf the numbers for all the interactive music services. So my point is, users are saying they want radio. The industry has been hyper-focused on on-demand music services. So my idea was, hey, let's go focus on the interactive music side, I mean, the online radio side of things, and see how we can improve that business, because I think it hasn't had a lot of investment in it. And so I think there's some really interesting ways that we can greatly improve that consumer experience. So that's what we've been working on.
Yeah, and it's an interesting idea, of course, to be able to scan the radio stations and to be able to provide that information in real time to consumers. And so sort of how do you go about doing that? And of course, it's quite a big undertaking given the number of radio stations that are around in the U.S. alone.
Right. So let me tell you what we're doing at Uber Stations. We just announced this service, and there's three really innovative things that we're doing. The first is we're tracking in real time what stations are playing.
Yeah.
And this is both songs and talk shows. Remember back when TV didn't have a guide, there was no interactive guide, and you would have to turn on the TV and it was, you know, who knows what it was, and you'd go through the channels one by one looking for something to listen to, I mean, to watch, you know, and you wouldn't stop because maybe there was something better three channels ahead. Well, that's kind of how radio is today. You turn it on and it, whatever's on is on, and you don't really have any insights into what is playing. Well, what we're doing now is tracking the songs and the shows that are playing on thousands of stations. So when you go to Uber Stations, we're going to display a list of all the radio stations near you that you're probably familiar with. These are AM, FM stations that are near you. But we're going to show you the songs that they're playing and the shows that they're playing. So that's innovation number one. Innovation number two is we figured out a way to stream AAC streams into a browser. About half of the radio stations that are online that are streaming in AAC format. And while MP3 streams really easy into a Flash player, AAC does not.
Yeah.
And so we figured out a way to do that. What this means for the user is that at Uber stations, you can click between stations and all of them play in one uniform interface.
That's great.
This is really unique. I mean, how a TV works, right? You don't have to go to a totally different viewer design every time you go to a station, but that's how radio still works. So that's the second thing that we're doing that's very innovative. The third thing is that because we're tracking the songs that are on and the shows that are on thousands of stations, when you're listening to a station, we've built in a recommendation engine that says, oh, you're listening to Maroon 5. Great. Well, here's 20 other stations that also play Maroon 5 songs.
Yeah.
If you're listening to an NPR show, All Things Considered, we say, oh, here's 10 other NPR shows that are on the radio right now, one click away. So we've built a recommendation engine around radio that uses the radio programmer as the intelligence engine.
Right.
So where Pandora uses the music genome trying to describe every song's characteristics, we're using the playlist that a radio station manager plays.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so in terms of looking at how the product is going to be deployed as well, do you have ideas as to you know, how you're going to move forward with it? Because, of course, you know, it's a project that right now is concentrated on the United States, but there's a lot of applications that can be seen worldwide. And so technically, how do you feel the rollout's going to be in terms of actually being able to successfully track all of the stations in the US and then subsequently move into international programming as well?
Right. Well, it's a big technical job. There's a reason nobody tracks what's playing in real time on radio stations today, and it's a very complex job. There's a lot of radio stations and different formats and different ways they make that content available or not.
Yeah.
And so we started focusing on the U.S., but we're quickly ramping up to include international stations as well. We launched last week a web version of our service, Uber Stations. So you can go to it. It's great on desktops. It's great on tablets. We just yesterday made a mobile version. So it looks okay on mobile. It doesn't work as slickly as a native app, but it's still usable. But I think adding to international is very important to us. And also figuring out how do you combine net stations with AM, FM? Right now, the way Uber Stations works is when you start up the app, we look at either your IP address or your latitude, longitude, location, and use that to find stations near you.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense for AM/FM because you probably know the stations that are in your region.
Yeah.
But net stations don't really have a location, you know? I mean, where is the absolute stations or SOMA? You know, just because I happen to broadcast out of San Francisco, SOMA is not a San Francisco, radio station. Yeah. So how do you blend to? We don't know the answer to that, but that's something we got to figure out because, you know, we want to combine net and, you know, traditional AM/FM radio operators into one comprehensive experience, and we don't know how to do that yet. So yeah. If you have an idea, Andrea, let us know.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's a really interesting startup and really looking forward to see how well it's going to go. It's uberstations.com and everybody can check it out. I'll throw the links in the show notes as well. And best of luck with it. It sounds like you got your hands full. So
great. Well, thanks so much. And I'm serious about if you have input or any of your listeners, feel free to drop me email, michael@dar.fm. I read everything. I take it to heart. And so if you've got input, don't hesitate to send it my way.
That's great. Thank you. And thanks a lot for listening. DMT is available on a variety of channels, as I mentioned at the beginning. Visit digitalmusictrends.com and check out the DMT one-to-one show, which has interviews with startups and companies working in the music digital marketing space. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.